Okay, we might kick off. Hello, and on behalf of the Retirement Incomes Working Group, I'd like to welcome you to this Institute of Actuaries Insight session on innovative income streams. My name is Darren Wickham, and it's my great pleasure to be chairing the session today. As you might be aware, the Retirement Incomes Working Group has developed a draft information note. And today, two of the principal authors are here to present and discuss that note. So this session is quite timely, as there's been some reasonably informed speculation that, or at least speculation based on the appearance of a Treasury person at the ASPA conference last week, that we may soon have a consultation paper from the DSS on means testing. You might recall last year it appeared at just Christmas Eve, so maybe this year we can look forward to our Christmas stocking being stuffed with another consultation paper instead of the proverbial lump of coal. So let me introduce our two speakers. Anthony Asher is Associate Professor with the University of New South Wales. Anthony believes the actuarial profession fulfills its social role by creating financial security for people. His working life has been divided between universities, regulator, including APRA, and more conventional life insurance and consulting roles. And the major theme of his current research is the development of appropriate post-retirement products and advice. So please welcome Anthony. So, please sit down, Anthony. I'll also introduce Paul. Paul Swinhoe is a life insurance specialist and has been a partner with Deloitte from 2000 until 2016. Over his career, he's developed a thorough understanding of the internal workings of life insurance businesses. Paul brings direct experience to this as the designer of Singapore's government-run LIFE, Life Income for the Elderly scheme that provides Singapore's retirees with their national pension. So please welcome Paul. And I hand you over to Anthony.
Thanks very much, Darren, and welcome to you all. This information note is still in pretty much draft form. We first started thinking about it as a guidance note, and then decided information was probably better because we disagreed so much on the content that it would be very difficult to agree on guidance. So please feel free to interject at any point. We will ask Darren to intervene if the debate gets too, well, one does, it continues for too long, but there are a number of really quite interesting issues in this field. So our agenda, I'll just talk to you about why this is important at the moment, for those of you who are not familiar with it, the different products that are available, SIPPers, which we'll explain when we get there if you don't know what they are, deferred annuities, and then most of the time on innovative annuities, the pooled annuities that are now, haven't really been used, and haven't been used in Australia and are still relatively unusual internationally. So what's new? At last, of 23 years or whatever it was, the SIS regulations now permit tax-free investment earnings on deferred life annuities and on what they defined as certain innovative superannuation income streams, which allow the payments to be contingent on investment returns and mortality experience. That came into force on the 1st of July. Prior to that, you couldn't actually issue an annuity unless you guaranteed it or the payments were increased in line with a fixed index or with the CPI. So the with-profit annuities that are available in Europe and the UK and South Africa were not permitted in a super fund. You could design them, but you couldn't. The investment earnings were taxed, and deferred life annuities were not permitted in a super fund. So the minimum drawdown rules do not apply to these products. They've got other restrictions on death benefits and surrender values. And there's a statement that income payments may not be unreasonably deferred. Also in the very useful in the new regulation, well, in the new regulatory environment, is that there's now a one-stop shop. So if you want to develop a new product, you can go to this streamlined cross-agency process. It includes the ATO, APRA, ASIC, and the Department of Social Services, which deals with the means test application of the benefits. So this is to facilitate the development of innovative products. And as Darren said, nothing on the means test yet. Right, so the different products we have, deferred annuities, been around for many years in one sense. When I first was doing valuation work in the 70s, we had deferred annuities, single premium deferred annuities from the 50s. So they're not a new idea. The idea is particularly that these should be sold starting at an advanced age, so at 80 or 85 rather than at retirement. And that gives you investment freedom until that advanced age. Possible two now to increase contingent deferred annuities that come into play after some event, ill health event, or I suppose even a market event potentially, loss of earnings or whatever. And then innovative annuities, which are differently called group self-annuitization, where the mortality risks are taken by the group. Investment-linked annuities, where effectively they are, one think of them as fixed guaranteed annuities, but they are denominated in units rather than in dollars. And with profit annuities, which invariably involve some level of discretion on the part of the board. Necessarily with the advice of the actuary. So all of these are available internationally. Paul has been involved in the, and I was also involved in the, to some extent, with the Singapore product. And a variety of new types of with-profit annuities are being introduced currently. So if you look at, for instance, Just Group in South Africa, it's got a with-profit annuity. I looked at recently, got a with-profit annuity where the return is equal to the average equity return over the last 6 years, and they dynamically hedge the guarantee. So there are all sorts of different things going on. So SIPRs, Comprehensive Income Product for Retirement. The Treasury paper came out last December, earlier I think, and the idea is that members should be defaulted, driven, and if they do nothing, should be moved towards an income product or an income package that provides a combination of flexibility, so they can get money out, maximum income. So there's some, particularly there's some pooling of the annuity mortality risk, so that you can spend more now because you're protected against the final against living too long, and risk management, which is the protection against living too long. And the idea is that the SIPRs should have some combination, perhaps, of existing products. So you've got here the three that are in the Treasury paper. You can have the wrap, so you have an account-based pension that goes, hopefully, to an advanced age, so 80, and then a deferred life annuity. And then to smooth any discontinuity here, and for ad hoc spending over your lifetime, you can have an account-based pension that can draw down as you like, and that they've shown the minimum drawdown. Just as a matter of interest, I have an honours student who's been looking at actual drawdowns from account-based pensions over the... we have a database of a couple of 100,000 people from 2006 to 2016. And about 30% of the money from those account-based pensions has come out via ad hoc drawdowns of various sorts, which is, I mean, just an interest. There's quite a big heterogeneity even within that 30%. There is some need for those ad hoc drawdowns. So the cut takes away the account-based pension, and the stack takes away the deferred life annuity product. So you've got takes away this ABP initially and has a deferred life annuity product starting at the beginning. So those are possibilities. We're really focusing here, we're going to discuss deferred life annuities. We're also going to discuss the deferred products. We're going to discuss longevity products with investment freedom. Paul's chance. No, mine. Right, okay. Right, we will organise this. So, a couple of things on deferred annuities. So the Kerwin is currently doing his master's on this thing, so he's the expert on this story. But there are a couple of issues. The one is to point out that if you look at this is just survivors of women aged 65, which are perhaps a sample of the type of annuity you're going to be selling. And this applies, the mortality issues apply to both deferred, whether the annuities are guaranteed or not. In the first 15 years, you basically have very little mortality. You expect very little mortality. And the consequence is there's actually very little mortality risk. The real risk happens later because this is where the volatility can arise. And, of course, the major uncertainty with mortality rates is the trend. And the particular issue is that there was virtually no change in longevity from Alpian's table in the 13th century to the 18th century. From the 18th century to expected life expectancy at 65 went up from about 7 to 11 by 1970. From 1970 to now, it's gone up from 11 to 18. So it's gone up. We've had this very dramatic change in the last little while, and that creates uncertainty. Is it going to continue, or is it not? Are we going to live forever, or in fact is obesity and just old age going to eventually mean that there's a maximum life expectancy? So that's the one issue, the trend. There's socioeconomic differences in mortality, so any fund, life insurer or super fund, one is going to have different experience, and it can be as much as 2-to-1, depending on your sample. And the big issue is, any new portfolio is going to have very few deaths initially. One, it'd be small, and two, is that the people who select annuities are quite likely, well, theoretically anyway, going to be those who are not sick. So you'll only have accidents and unsurprising heart attacks, etc. So it may take, and we don't know how long temporary initial selection will last. Perhaps, I seem to remember figures from the States of perhaps as much as 10 years. So you'll need a portfolio at least 11 or 12 years old before you have any idea of what your experience is going to be relative to the average. And the other element relating to deferred annuities is that if they become a significant portion of your book, they are particularly difficult because the management action is very limited. For term, you can't change the benefit conditions. Your claims management is trivial. You can't do anything about that. Expenses are minor, so the expenses aren't really nothing you can do about that. You're not getting new premiums, so you can't even change you can barely change your investments. All you can do is effectively raise capital or sell the business or get some reinsurance, which amount to the same thing. So it's quite, and the major question there is when you're doing that, the person who's going to provide you with the capital is almost certainly going to have a more pessimistic view of your future than you are. So you'll be raising the capital on unfavorable terms. So the need for capital in some way or other to protect the business is important. And finally, I just mentioned there's an articulation issue when the deferred life annuity starts. The issue is if you have an account-based pension for 10 years or 15 years and then a deferred life annuity, if they're investment profits, they're going to affect the size of those annuities in different ways, even if they're identically invested. If they're not identically invested, you are at some risk of running out before the deferred life annuity starts. And that risk needs to be considered. It's one of the things that the Department of Social Security has to decide, because if they include the deferred life annuity in your assets, you may end up with no financial assets and no income, but no age pension because you've got lots of assets that you've got to survive for another few years to get. So it's a, that articulation issue is a particular one that needs to be considered, and why I personally prefer packages where the two products are linked and profits can be shifted easily between the two.
Well, Anthony's introduced the concept of what he personally prefers. As you can tell by looking at us, we have a strong vested interest in this subject. So the reward to all of you in this room is that if you design the best innovative product, then we'll buy it. But I'm still working because it hasn't been done yet. Conventional annuities are quite straightforward from the customer's point of view. They know what they're going to get. They know how long they're going to get it for. Once we start sharing the risk, the insurer doesn't take so much risk, but the annuitant takes some of the risk, albeit pooled, then we need a lot more rules as to how things will be determined. So I'm not going to be talking about all of these, but these are the things to be thinking about, and you may want to come back to particular aspects of these when it comes to your questions. But we do need a rule for what will the annuity payment be, recognizing the amount of risk that's being taken by the participant. How will mortality and investment experience be shared? Different answers in different products. Will you have withdrawal and death benefits? How selective will you assume that the action of withdrawal is, or the impact that death benefits has on the choices that people make? Will you be providing investment or mortality guarantees to help smooth out the returns and to iron through some of the vagaries of the products? How will you express your charges? Particularly important is how will you communicate it? An annuity is a simple product. An innovative annuity is less simple. Scope for misunderstanding. Scope for people as they get into their older ages of forgetting what they've been told, willfully misunderstanding, merely forgetting. And finally, it's a small annuity market. Not every product will succeed. You don't want to end up with 20 or 30 of these. They won't work from a pooling point of view. So designing in up front how this will not be a legacy product is a good idea. And as you'll see as we talk through this, then there's going to be a trade-off between the complexity or simplicity of what you're designing and the what you might call true equity, where people do sort of exactly get their returns. And smoothing is, I guess, the concept that goes is not true equity. So let's go back to basics. How do annuities work? We all understand insurance, that a lot of people pay a small premium, and a small number of people who are unlucky enough to die, or maybe they're lucky enough to die, they win. They get a lot. Annuities set that whole process into reverse, that you get a small amount out of it, but if you die, then you forfeit your share of the pool. It's important to for actuaries to understand the difference between big A's and little A's. So here we're going to go back to little A's. So starting at the top here, then annuity of $1 a year is worth AX. We're familiar with that. If you deconstruct it, then what happens, you're reading that formula across from left to right, is that at the end of the year, you will get a payment of one if you're still alive. And you will continue to have the right to future payments. Your annuity will now be worth AX plus one. But not everyone will get to the end of the year. QX will die. So it's only the one minus QX that will be getting this. And finally, because you've got to the end of the year, you've had a year's interest, so discount it for a year to get back to the start. Nothing very magical there. Just turn that around and think of it from the point of view of a survivor. If you're someone who has got to the end of the year, how much do you want in your pot in order to be able to continue to get $1 a year? Obviously, what you started the year with of AX will earn a year's interest. At the end of the year, it will pay out one to you, being your annuity. And the complicated bit on the right is what you need your balance topped up by so that you have enough to continue to expect to get one a year from there on. So I'm calling that the survival credit. And if you look at that formula, then it's simply the amount that you started the year with multiplied by QX. So this is what the deaths have forfeited. So death is a bad thing, but particularly in an annuity, because you've lost that much of your pool. And that then gets spread quite thinly. QX is a small number. 1 minus QX is very close to 1. And that gets spread amongst all the survivors. But that's how an annuity works. Exactly what you'd forfeit because you die is what you need to add to the balance of the survivors in order for them to keep going. So this is what underlies particularly groups self-annuitization. So let's look at group self-annuitization. Mortality is pooled. I'm picturing that you're invested in a unitized fund of your choice of how risky that is. It could be very low risk. But at age X, you are holding UX units in a unitized fund. That will buy you an annuity of UX divided by AX units. So while the price of that will vary from year to year, that is what your starting expectation for that annuity will be. Now, the formula that we finished the last slide of, re-expressed in unit terms here, is the balance that you need at the end of the year is, in unit terms, are the units that you started the year with, and with any luck, they'll have had some good performance during the year, so they're worth a bit more. You will have had a payment paid out, so P units will have been paid out to you, and you get a survival credit. And again, that's the number of units of the people who died, UX times QX, spread amongst the survivors. So that is your survival credit, or that's what you need to get if this annuity is going to continue to give you the same payment in unit terms as you had at the start of the year. This too is not a new formula. If you want to go back to the Reinventing Annuities paper that came out in 2001, that's where it comes from. So we're not talking about anything that's new, but it's certainly new quite probably to a lot of people in the room and also new to Australia generally. So how do we apply this? And how do we make the product work? We need to start off with assumptions that we can essentially put into AX in order to work out what your payout is going to be. Assumptions for mortality, for interest, and for inflation. So, and Anthony's already discussed some of the difficulties of choosing a mortality assumption and of indeed taking quite a long time to find out whether you're right or wrong. We know that mortality differs between different groups. There's a strong socioeconomic effect there. We know less in Australia about how selective annuitants will be. But if you're designing a product, you need to think about, are you going to have just one pool that everybody joins, or are you going to have different pools? If you're an industry super fund that expects to get a large number of people from a particular subgroup, would you price those differently from others? Or would you have different expectations of them from others? How much should you allow for selection of the people who choose an annuity? How much is there ongoing selection for that subgroup? I figure that if you've got a bunch of annuitants and they, let's say, 50-60% of population mortality, will they stay at 50-60% of population mortality? Or will they converge towards it? I figure that after 20 or 30 years, the proportion of that group that is still alive is much larger than it was to start with, and they're likely to be converging towards population mortality. And you're going to be wanting to think about mortality improvement. How much? How is it going to go on? How will it develop? Is it going into reverse? The advantage is that if you're dealing with youngish, I'm happy enough to call 65 youngish. Bear with me on that. Not too many laugh, that's good. Mortality rates are still quite low. So actually getting it wrong doesn't matter very much, because what drives an annuity is actually the survivorship. So if 99% survive, it doesn't make much difference if it's 99 or 99.5. That's a massive difference in the mortality rate. That does build up year after year after year. And if you've designed a product where the risk is being taken by the pool, you've got time for that, letting those differences emerge and flow through into the payouts. The interest rate to assume in the AX you're going to divide into the number of units people have is a tough one. If you start off with too low an interest rate, then as earnings come in higher than that, then it's going to be, you know, naturally lead to higher payouts as the amount in people's account is more than they actually needed to sustain their payout. The impact that has is that the people who live a long time will get nice big incomes late in life, and the people who've died early have, with hindsight at any rate, been deprived of as high an income as they might have enjoyed. Similarly, if you allow for too high an interest rate, then payouts to start with will be higher, which means that there is less left around for payouts at later ages. The question should go through a microphone. I'll repeat that one. Was there much contention on the task force about that point? No, because we're trying to draw out the issues rather than resolve them. Do you need a microphone if you're going to? No, I'm happy to take discussion as we go, and if it's too distracting, then we'll come back to it.
It's been quite a few years now since I've been involved in pricing investment-linked annuities, but maybe not as many years as you, Paul, but I didn't see this one as contentious at all. Now, maybe that's age, maybe that's sort of developed in time, but the converse of what you're describing is if you factor in some equity risk premium, you're giving the benefit of that, despite the risk not being born, giving the benefit of that to annuitants that happen to die early, which seems distinctly inequitable to me. So my recollection of investment linked annuities pricing, when you put it up kind of the UX over AX to arrive at your P, your A in that formula is a zero interest rate from memory. It's an expectation formula, or maybe it's a risk-free formula, but it's certainly not got equity risk premium in it. So, I mean, maybe it's a point for later, but I mean, the things that are up on the slide there, that one surprised me a bit.
Okay, good points. I'll think about that while I carry on. It's probably the best thing to do. Yes, I've certainly seen unit-linked annuities using zero. My experience on the Singapore scheme, where it really had close to being guaranteed investment returns, was to use that guaranteed investment return. Didn't give the prospect of rising payouts through investment returns. And finally, inflation. It's highly desirable from the point of view of the annuitant that inflation is allowed for, that they maintain their real value of their annuity. It's also fraught as to how do you build in inflation into this. There are various ways that people have proposed it we'll allow for 3/4 of the inflation, or we'll allow for the actual inflation less 2%. You really need a design that will handle both high and low inflation, all of it playing into the situation where we're not really sure how much money people need in their retirement. There's a general understanding that as you when you enter the later years of your retirement, whenever you might do that, then your spending goes down. Unless, of course, you're spending more on health. So actually understanding people's needs is something that it would be good if we understood more of, as to actually how much inflation to build in. But the idea that matching, designing it for, say, 3/4 of inflation might end up with really lousy returns if inflation gets back to double figures. So I took these slides out. Anthony put them back in again. Have I not covered anything that you wanted covered at this stage?
Can I get a couple of minutes on them?
Yeah.
Thank you. So this goes to Duncan's question in a way. So can you anticipate the equity risk premium? I think the answer is absolutely yes, without any question of you're not in this in these smooth portfolios subsidizing anyone. You've got a set of rules, and there's no point in taking investment risk unless you're going to enjoy some of the benefits of it, and you don't necessarily want to wait till later to do so. I would also argue there are huge reasons to avoid fixed interest investments in that, government stock at 1% is hugely distorted by the Reserve Bank and by foreigners who want liquidity. They don't represent a real return to Australian investors. So I think you're much better off investing a reasonable share in equity, which gives you a high expected return, and there's no reason not to enjoy it earlier. You might, a number of, in South Africa, where I'm very familiar, and in the UK, they very often allow you to choose how much to anticipate. So you can price the AIR, can be 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7, or whatever, and you choose the rate, and depending on the rate, so you will get a cash flow initially. If investment returns are good, you maintain it. If they're not, you'll have a decline. So the important not to take up the equity risk premium much above 6%. That is really not justified by the numbers, even though you might find people suggesting it's an acceptable number. It's not. And you need to read Dimroy Elson. And Damaradan and the academic stuff that's looked at more carefully. 6% is really the top end. On mortality experience, we've discussed some of it. No, all of that. So, I'll leave that too.
Did I say enough about inflation to satisfy you?
No, I want to emphasize this one too. Sorry. I have seen often actuaries price at 75% of inflation. Just 2 months, 2 or 3 months ago, product had to be changed from 75% of inflation to 2% below inflation because it wasn't robust to inflation changes. Now, I did my economics in 1974 when inflation jumped to 15%, and in South Africa stayed at 15% for 20 years. You young guys, believe that inflation is 2% and never going to change. You do need to look at history. You do need to think about the fact that we have higher, QE has changed the banking level, debt to a level that 40 years ago would have predicted would create huge hyperinflation. There is a huge risk that between now and our age, and when we hope to die, plan to die, and then we're talking from now till 2060, that there will be bouts of hyperinflation. And to lose 25% of 15% a year for 5 or 6 years is not fun. So don't design them that way. And
when you're saying this product has to change, how did that process work?
Anthony, can you repeat the question?
The question was the product had to be changed. It wasn't in this jurisdiction. They closed the old business and opened a new one. So that was a problem. If you think about it, your tolls we're paying, those toll roads are sold on 2.5% on inflation or 4.5%, whichever was the higher. That was a straight bet on inflation. Had no investment merit. It's a stupid contract, and we're paying much too much for our tolls as a consequence. Someone didn't understand inflation. So that's why I want to emphasize it. There are people out there who don't understand inflation. It's the actuary's job to make sure that you do understand and you speak up when someone comes up with silly ideas. Thank you.
I like the last bit. So the other aspect of a group self-annuitization scheme is distributing the survivorship credit. So these are all the amounts that have been forfeited by the people who died, the balances of the people who have died. A few slides back, if you'll recall, then each survivor needs their survivorship credit, the number of units multiplied by the expected to be, or this is what they need, times QX over 1 minus QX. That will maintain their payout in unit terms. Of course, actual experience will be different. You'll have a bigger pool or a smaller pool, and therefore you need to decide how to distribute the difference. And I think the most obvious way to do that is in proportion to the expectation, in proportion to SX. If you've got more than that, then boost everyone by a certain proportion, but it's fair to say we haven't all agreed on that. We have agreed that you need the SX kind of to start with, and the variations are from that. But if you've got more, then that could be in proportion to your perhaps your account balance, or perhaps some other measure. And if you do that, then you get you get a proportional increase or reduction to your expected income. Sense of fairness for judging this is that, you know, it's a fair game if you your expectation of what you lose is equal to the expectation of what you win, which is how it's set up. That if you look at the top of the slide there to the formula for SX, then UX times QX is what the deaths expect to lose, and spread that amongst the 1 minus QX is what the each survivor expects to win. And because there are a lot more survivors than deaths, then the value is equal on both sides. So this gives you the mechanism for distributing the survivorship credits that gets boosted into each person's account. Along with that, you would need to get some good communication so they understand what is going on, they understand how the payouts are varying, they understand the risks that the pool is taking, so that they have a chance to, well, so that they don't get surprised and they have a chance to adjust their lifestyle as those payouts go up and down. In the early years, the survivorship credits aren't going to be all that great. You're going to get more volatility from, I would expect, from the performance of the unit-linked fund than from the survivorship credits. They really come into their own, you know, later in retirement. Once QX gets up to 5% or 10%, and you're well into your 80s by that stage, then that's when these survivorship credits come to be a significant addition to your account balance. So my experience from Singapore was that, you know, the most that someone was getting for survivorship credits was, you know, I think it was sort of around 7 or 8% of their account balance. Most people were getting well under 1%. Interest income into the account was far more important than survivorship credits to start with. But it will change. That will develop as time goes on. The other interesting thing you're faced with is what happens when you recognize you didn't get the assumptions right and you want to change them. The amount that you're going to be paying out is the number of units divided by your AX. So if you're going to change the assumptions underlying AX, you're going to change the payout. So changing assumptions creates volatility. It will create a step change in the payout. So you need to have prepared people for the step change, particularly if it's a step change downwards. And if you're not too sure about the assumption, which is always going to be the case, if you change it too quickly, then you might change it back again, and so people won't know what's going on. And if you change it too slowly, then people will see that, well, they had a small payout reduction last year and not a small payout reduction thereafter because people, the pool was living longer. So they start to expect those ongoing payout reductions. So is it better to give people a sort of a steadily declining income or a step change and then keep it flat? And so they're the sorts of questions that you need to answer. And you've also got equity issues between the pool and new entrants. If it was just a pool, then it doesn't actually matter so much because people will still get the distribution of the profits to the members of the pool. The terms on which you bring new members in can transfer value from the pool to the new members or back again. So particularly if you've got overly generous assumptions and you're letting new members in on those, then those new members are picking up value from the existing members. You can, of course, you don't have to have one pool. You could do all of this for a number of pools. So if you could close off a pool, you recognize experience is changing, start a new pool. But it's going to be hard enough to getting a pool up to a decent size. So I would be quite discouraging of starting new pools. You could have members of the pool on different mortality rates. So this group of a particular worker group perhaps might have one less set of mortality rates. A different group might have another set of mortality rates. You're discriminating your mortality rates by age and gender, kind of so obviously that we forget that's a discrimination. But so the pools are always participating according to their own QX. That the formulae that drives this are all driven by the QX that is ascribed to you. So that could be by age, by gender, and by what sort of characteristics the scheme has been priced on.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Anthony.
Right. So the previous slide we have. I think Paul and I are not quite yet on the same page on it because there's which do you do? Do you capitalize a change or not? I don't allow for capitalization, mainly because what happens is that if you've got you need someone to exercise their discretion, and what will happen over the period of time is that the people who are exercising discretion will have different views on what's going on. And what they will do, so you get a new guy in who's got to think, guy, girl, whatever, got to think about the assumptions, will decide because they want to make changes that they've got to change the assumptions, and then 5 years later something else will change. You say, well, that doesn't happen. It does happen. So the Swedish government have the notional defined contribution pension, and they change the interest rate from 4% to 2% and back to 4% over a period of 5 years. Creating some silly, unnecessary volatility. It doesn't matter in the case of that particular fund because it's just a top-up on the age pension. But I think you should take that discretion away from future people to just avoid unnecessary thinking. Suzanne?
Are you envisaging that there's no commutation option for this?
There would be a balance. I'm envisaging that if you probably want to protect your pool by not allowing people to withdraw their money, otherwise you're going to have QX Select instead of QX Ultimate. And the problem with if you do offer those options is that then people forget to, because they're in hospital at the time, and then they come back and say, well, I could have exercised my commutation option. I think better not have them. It still allows you. I mean, my experience when I was in life insurance when we sold annuities is that we allowed commutation for in need with a medical examination. You're still allowed to do something like that, although there will be problems with the Treasury rule, the regulations as to whether it's permitted or not. But if it is permitted, even if it's permitted, you can, but you do need to have medical advice. to protect your pool. So expenses and profits, again, these are very long-term contracts. You do need to protect. You need to protect both sides. For the issuer, you need to protect increase in expenses due to inflation, to regulatory changes, tax and new APRA fees or LASIC fees or whatever it is, and maybe even for small portfolio volumes, small portfolios that either have never grown or actually were big and now get small again later, and expenses become high. So you need to consider that. But on the other hand, you also need to protect the annuitants against opportunistic changes to investments in distribution rules and increases in charges. So you can't take too much discretion, and I don't think the regulator should allow you to take too much discretion. I certainly have seen over my lifetime many situations where companies have taken advantage of legacy products. I mean, the banks do it all the time. Low interest rates for new business, low interest rates for existing business, high interest rates for new business. New series introduced, innovative, fancy products, lower premium rates because they select, and then you forget, you put all the junk investments into the legacy products. Those are really, you do need to think about protecting now in advance rather than later. It's too late. So my view is that I think we should try and put in, as Paul suggested, some sort of provision for transferring the business. And I think we should actually, you should limit the expense charges to current plus inflation and changes to the law. I think that's a fair way of doing it. But that needs to be thought of carefully, and you need some lawyers to think about it too. And the regulators need to think about it carefully, because many companies will not put that protection in, and it's too late in 30 years' time when you've got some skellum, some crook running the company, or opportunist running the company. You laugh, it will happen. It's 40 years, it's a long, long time. The Royal Commission will have been finished, dead and buried in 30 years' time, and I'm 92, I do not want my pension to be consumed because someone's decided that the investments will be changed to cash only and interest rates are sitting at -2. It happens. Has happened and can happen again. You can't stop that, but you can at least think about it in advance. So legacy products, so for investment returns using unit pricing rules, in other words, new business and withdrawals and payments should not changes in those should not change the benefits of the other people. Smoothing, very difficult. You need to minimize discretions. So the standard approach, why with profits are not allowed here, because the actuaries made recommendations to the board didn't accept the recommendations or put pressure on the actuaries, and basically smoothing tends to be downwards. The huge assets arise that are then expropriated for demutualization or something. These things are so that's the risk of depreciation. They need to be robust to long periods of underperformance. You need to stress test your annuity rules on the Japanese stock market from 1980 through to today. If it doesn't survive that, probably not good enough. Mortality experience, so minimum size rules. It seems to me that you can it doesn't probably matter when the pool is very small, but if people are expecting a regular mortality credit, there's no reason why you shouldn't enter into a contract with an insurance company or a reinsurer as like a reverse long-term yearly renewable term contract. So they will pay you the QXs based on their view of mortality for the next 3 years. So there's no guarantee or very limited guarantee in the actual in the rate, but they do. They're taking the idiosyncratic risk. So you turn a small portfolio into a big one. You need to ask yourself what level of volatility is acceptable, which you're going to do anyway because of the investments. Mentioned temporary initial selection. Deviations from experience probably should be based on the same factors as in pricing. Okay, that was that. Was your slide? Was it? Yep.
So while we spend a lot of time talking about group self-annuitisation, it's worth a few words on investment-linked annuities. As Anthony said, these are annuities expressed in units rather than dollars. And you're insuring your, from the participant's point of view, you're insuring your longevity, but you're not insuring the investment performance. I have had time while I've been sitting there to think about what Duncan was saying earlier, and I agree that if you're doing your AXs on unit-linked annuities, then you'll do that at zero interest. The interest will come through in the performance of the units rather than in the number of units that you're forfeiting each, you're getting paid out each year. But they're slightly more complicated than straightforward annuities because you've got expenses that are expressed in dollars and you've got a liability that's expressed in units. And probably your greatest capital risk is that you have really fantastic investment performance because the margins you need above that, if people are going, you know, the longevity margins on fabulous investment performance, you could be quite large. So it changes the way that you look at them. That's all I wanted to say about investment-linked units, investment-linked annuities, and that's what we had to say. So we're in a world where innovative income products are being encouraged and provoked. So we've been talking through the ways they could work, particularly focusing, you know, we had the deferred annuities, self-annuitization schemes, indexed annuities. We haven't specifically talked about with-profits annuities. They contain all of the elements of other things and are that much more complicated. If anyone is brave enough to try and sell one, then I'd be surprised. If anyone's brave enough to buy one, I'd be surprised. I think that the faith in institutions is such that, trust me, it's a with-profits annuity, is going to be a very hard story to sell. Nevertheless, I look forward to being able to buy an innovative income product from someone in this room in the near future.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Anthony. I'll go back to Anthony's bio when he said one of the things he wants to do with his career is to help people understand financial uncertainty. And for a life insurance company, actuaries help life companies and shareholders understand the impact of financial uncertainty. But in a world where there's a GSA and there's no capital, what is the role of the actuary? Who are we helping with that financial uncertainty? So I'm interested in your views around the roles of actuaries in GSAs.
So I think we're experts in this area. One is the question. Is this not on?
The big question perhaps is volatility. Is volatility. We don't know the extent to which volatility creates unhappiness in people. So that's a big question. And there are other questions related to post-retirement. How much are people paying for out-of-pocket medical costs? How much do you really need for aged care? Now, we purport to give advice to people. The organizations that we serve purport to give advice to people at 65 to prepare themselves for old age. And the decisions they make at 65 will impact them at 95, and 30% of them will get there over 90 anyway. The role of actuaries is to find out what they need and to give them advice, not your idea based on what your grandparents had, but what's actually happening out there. And I think the industry has been shockingly slack in thinking through what actually happens out on those long distances. Sorry, I mean, I'm part of the industry. I've ignored the problem to a degree. It becomes more and more pressing as we get older, as they say. So I think that's one of the stories, is actually to research what do people need, what are people doing. One of the answers comes from what are people actually doing in the with their account-based pension. So if you're not subscribing to the Strategic Insights database, please, your company's not doing that, please, can you do that? And can you come and talk to me about, if you're interested, lots of research projects that we could think about doing that. The other thing is to find investments that actually are smoother. So in equities, I don't think government stock is a good idea. I don't think equities are a perfectly good idea. But there are all sorts of things that actually that industry has done in the past that have been lost in a way that need to be thought of again. So we had, at one point, we had split unit trusts with the dividends and the capital gains separately. So the dividends are much smoother than the capital gains. We used to be able to buy annuity bonds. Corporate bonds and government bonds used to be annuities rather than the balloon payments. We need those again. For those of you who haven't read my salary mortgage paper in the Australian Actuarial Journal in 2011, that's another idea. We do need to think, I think, about ways of creating underlying cash flows that allow for lower volatility, because I think that's one of the things that people are looking for.
So my answer to that question is more around, you know, our role as actuaries is to create fairness amongst all the participants in the pool, to be able to run this pool, I guess, invisibly to the participants, so that the amount that's distributed by way of the survivorship credits in an RSA, in bonuses if you do a with-profits annuity, does reflect a sense of fairness to those participants, that you have done the best you can to identify the mortality rates that underlie the lives that you have, and how those mortality surpluses or those mortality profits will be shared amongst the pool. What is the shape of the curve by age? How might that change? And I think the other side of that is, because there's uncertainty there, is making sure that the communication does the best it can to help people understand what risks they are taking by getting into a GSA. I think GSAs are great ideas because they don't have a cost of capital associated with them. They have a good chance of providing a better return throughout your retirement for your retirement monies. But it comes at a risk, and people need to understand that risk and be prepared to take it. And particularly, they need to be able to cope with it once their mental facilities decline and they're therefore less flexible in the way they look at life and less flexible their thinking is. We do have one saving grace, and that is the age pension. So if it is completely stuffed up, they've still got an age pension. So it's not the end of the world. It's a big shame, but not quite a catastrophe. But going back to our role is to get that done as fairly as we can, so that the participants have the best chance of understanding what they're getting and enjoying a retirement with as high as a good level of income as they can reasonably expect.
Which is moving, I guess, towards a more traditional actuarial role in a life company as a sort of a guardian of equity. Okay, questions from the floor? Duncan.
Anthony, you mentioned trust, I think, was the word you used around some of these products. I can't get past being struck by the complexity of some of these things. I think one of the saving graces, despite it compulsion now having ceased in the UK annuity market, one of the saving graces when it did exist was did foster a lot of innovation. So all the things that you've described have all been or come and maybe gone in the UK market over time. So they've had investment-linked annuities. Yes, they've had with-profits annuities. I know they're in South Africa as well. They've even had unitized with-profits annuities, which was sort of an attempt at unitizing with-profits process and, you know, the insurer underwriting longevity. But they've also had GSAs. I mean, the Prudential, I think you mentioned the flexible, I forget the name of that paper, that Institute of Actuaries paper in the UK, a flexible annuity, reinventing annuities, I think it's, yeah. So you know, the Pru launched a product that was doing this around about 2001, 2002. Last I heard, it didn't sell very much. Astron launched a product like that in 2006 here, give or take, didn't sell much.
There were tax problems with that.
Well, okay, so I want to come to that. So I'm prepared to place a bet that, you know, that removing the tax problem won't be a panacea to suddenly, you know, an Astron product, at least in the retail market, going, you know, taking selling like hotcakes. So I suppose I'm kind of intrigued. Do you see, it's a long intro following question, GSAs, do you see them as having more application in a, if you like, a government-mandated arrangement, a la sort of Singapore? I'm not that familiar with exactly how the Singapore, was it the Provident Fund or something, works, or in an environment of compulsion or something close to compulsion? Because there have been a few attempts at these things in the retail market, because, for example, the Pru one didn't sell, and yet it had no tax disadvantages. It had no means testing disadvantages in the UK. It sat in a compulsory annuity environment, but it still didn't sell. So, you know, all of these products, I think I've remarked on this before, have one thing in common, which is they're all great ideas, but at least tried in other markets, they just haven't worked. And, you know, there are obviously other examples along the way. So I'm very conscious that the road is littered with kind of casualties of innovation in this space. At quite considerable cost, GMWBs have been tried in this market. You know, the Astron product as well. I'm intrigued to see how Mercer go with their GSA. But it strikes me that one of the things that I think people have really struggled with is once you get past the simplicity of a lifetime annuity, coming back to trust, the complexity of these things for a retiree, and particularly as they kind of aim to keep their faculties through their 70s and their 80s, Paul, as you alluded to, is a real hindrance here, or could be a real hindrance to success here.
It's the issue. One anecdote. Relates to the fact I don't believe that the financial advisors either understand the issues, nor are poorly incentivized, in fact, incentivized not to sell annuities. But, you know, it's not a question, it's partly understanding, it's partly that their motivation. I remember on one occasion I mispriced our 4-year term annuities. I gave a special deal, so it was outside the normal system. Instead of pricing them at 19%, I priced them accidentally at 24%, which was fine because of the South African interest rates had peaked and they were coming down, and we were longer. We had long investments. We got to make a profit. And we sold. I gave a 14-day special offer, and we sold less annuities in that 14 days than at any other time of the year. They just didn't do the sums. We should have sold more. So you can offer them something that is very simple to understand and very obviously advantageous to their clients, and they won't necessarily buy it. It's a sort of cultural thing, and it comes. Senior management, including most of us, don't think annuities are important because we expect to live on our dividend income. Don't see the need for small amounts of annuities. So we've. From our little sample of 200,000 or 300,000 account-based pensions, 30% of the people are drawing level dollar amounts, not the minimum, and the average of that is $5,500 per annum. There is a demand out there for small, regular monthly payments. It's there. It doesn't even cross, well, in fact, we've had arguments in the strategy group, people saying no one is going to spend $50,000 or $100,000 on an annuity. No demand, because we cannot actually understand that $5,000 a year can make a difference to people's lives. It does. Half the population is living on $20,000 per annum on the age pension. $5,000 makes a difference at that level. So I think that's a really important thing. Plus the fact that the companies, the way they operate, don't like set-and-forget products. Neither the financial advisors nor the companies make money if you check a product and you put it in your bottom drawer and it just pays regular amounts. So I think the culture is such that we've moved away from annuities, compulsory annuities, or corporate annuities, because we don't think they're profitable. and we don't think they're needed. They are needed, and the profit, they can be profitable, they're just not going to reduce costs, returns on capital in ways, or profits in ways that perhaps are not palatable to the industry. And if the industry doesn't respond, then it will be necessary for government to intervene. And I think there's a growing appetite within government to say there needs to be an intervention. So there's one other of these questions. Two-thirds of the people who benefit from annuities are women. When I raise that point and say this is a women's issue, Australian men are quite happy to take an account-based pension, spend the money, and then leave the widows on the age pension. All right? That's what's happening. I raise that with men, and they refuse to hear it. Okay? Guys, you know that. Your wife must tell you regularly you don't listen to her, or your spouse, or whatever it is. It's the way it operates. I'm afraid even the women involved, who I talk to normally, are not interested anyway, because you're going to have a super balance at least as large as your husband's. And some of you will be subsidizing them. The people that are concerned are the women who take time out, more than half the population take time out of their careers and have less super at the end of their lives, or divorced at some point without an adequate advice and end up with less money at 90. Those are the people we've got to protect. Now you can think, well, how many of them are there? Well, I reckon probably 5 to 10% of the population. And if you think about life insurance, how many people die before 65? Less than 5% of the population. The industry exists for that number of people. It really is, that's what we're talking about. That's what we've got to think about. They're a forgotten minority, and we need to do something about them.
I might come back to the complexity point just briefly. I asked an executive of a US insurer, how come your variable annuity products sell so well? In Australia, they don't sell. They've never been a success. He looked me straight in the eye and he said, a 7% upfront commission. 7%. It can overcome any complexity. That's amazing. That's not going to fly here. Okay, so another question?
Yeah, I've got a question. Thanks, Anthony and Paul, for the presentation, and it's good to hear that you're thinking about these issues. You called out a number of important questions, among them indexing and fees, and the issues that we're thinking about as well. What scope is there to address those via actuarial standards?
Good question.
Fees and what was the other one?
Indexing.
I hadn't particularly seen it as needing an actuarial standard. I think that we're talking about products in the marketplace, and therefore, what will the
Indeed. What
can you make fly in the market?
Yeah, I guess my concern on indexing is that I wouldn't like to see providers competing on their representation of their products on the basis of the indexing, so they can present a higher projected return if they're using a lower level of indexing. So that's something that looks attractive if you don't understand indexing. And I think that there'd be a clear incentive to do that if there wasn't a guideline of some sort, and I'm exploring whether that can be done through actuarial standards or not.
Interesting point. It's once you start competing on the assumptions that you're making, then you get a period of chaos. I mean, when back in the 80s, then people were competing on the illustration rate that they used for their investment account products, or your unit link products, as whether you were illustrating a 10% or a 12% or a 17% growth rate, and telephone numbers at the end of at the end of the product. And eventually it was the regulator who came in and said, right, you will use this rate. So it's a question of whether it's regulation by the Institute of Actuaries or by, in those days it was the Life Insurance Commissioner or the ISC, but probably would be ASIC nowadays, setting the rules of the game. So if the game is being played unfairly, that's a very good point, then it would be for a regulatory body to step in and say,
play fair, guys.
So the interesting thing for a GSA on expenses is if there's no guarantee around what the expense can be in the future and the pool shrinks or the product's not successful, then the consumer could have a quite significant fee. So there's a consumer expectations issue. But as soon as you put some caps on the fee, well, then you've almost got a capital issue. You're providing a guarantee, and then do you need at least operational risk or some sort of reserving for potential expense blowout in the future?
Yeah, on expenses, I think you'd need a principles-based approach somehow, because we don't want to see these products going bust because of costs out of their control. But if you've got a captive market because you've got a low commutation value, then the potential to gouge those customers 10 or 20 years down the track is very significant. Mm. In answer to your question, Duncan, I think we've got an experiment, and it's largely an experiment on the basis of the SIPA framework, which has not been released yet. So how powerful that default nudge will be, it's an open question.
So yes, I think that's a good point, and I wanted to come back on Duncan's question that it's a question of how these products get accepted and how they get, particularly if you can get them in as a SIPA, then, and if you say the default product, then it'll be the direction that people might go in. But I quite agree, the complexity is something that will need to be got across, and people will need to get into the frame of mind that they have to take a product. Which one is the best one? And as Anthony said, we've got to get the advisors across it so that they can be in a position to advise.
Okay.
Sorry. So can I? Yeah. Sorry. Actuarial agreement would only work if the actuary has the power to recommend to the board the assumptions on the illustration mechanisms and the indexation mechanisms. So that's the issue. And then the actuaries are probably in a better position than to create an industry guidance than ASIC. I wouldn't trust. I'm sorry. Yep. Okay. No, I didn't say. Forget that. I will say that part of the issue is in South Africa in the 90s, we actually had the Life Office Association had an industry agreement that we stuck the projections right because. That's not possible. I wouldn't think it was possible here because the ACCC would regard that as anti-competitive. So I think you need to understand that industry agreements don't work because we're not allowed to talk to each other very often and not allowed to agree with each other. So it does require the regulator to step in, and the profession could do it, but only if the profession was given the power.
Okay. Other questions? Comments?
Thank you for this insightful discussion. There was one statement in GSA which said dynamic hedging and option strategies may create systemic risks. So my question is around if anything, it may relieve some pressure from companies at bad times, especially if guarantees are provided. So if you can please explain that a little bit more.
So, yeah, if Webb Madison was here, he would tell me that was wrong. So let me say this is also partly controversial. So the question is that if you've got, like the 1987 crash, which is apparently created by the fact that people had constant proportion portfolio insurance, so they had to sell when the share market dropped. You've got a lot of dynamic hedging requires you to sell when the market is falling. You might be buying put options, but if you're buying put options, the person who's hedging on the other side is selling. So also these contracts where you have to sell when volatility rises actually also has the impact normally when the market drops that you have to sell. So the question arises, is this a systemic, if there are too many people out there and there's insufficient liquidity in the market, could that cause the market to crash and to spiral down as it did in 1987? And I mean, the UK 1973 example is even worse because it then went down for a year and never didn't turn around. There's a broker's note from Deutsche Bank that suggests that the amounts are quite considerable. They reckon that in the week of Brexit, $50 billion of shares were sold as a consequence of the fall in the share price, and it had a 1 or 2% impact for a week on the market. So it got a visible impact on the market, but doesn't the market what turned out to be adequately liquid for enough buyers around to turn it around. Might that change at some point? Well, if more, the more people are in this doing dynamic hedging, the more it becomes likely. Particularly if there are a whole lot of people that don't have the freedom to sell or to buy because they are forced by indexing rules or portfolio rules not to participate. So one does need to be conscious of the possibility that the market goes out of kilter as a consequence of just an interesting aside. I'm totally irrelevant, but I got in touch with the Financial Markets Control Group in New York, and he said they're actually it's one of their issues of possible problems in the American market. So I said, oh, he said, well, you could do some research, couldn't you? And I said, yeah, we could do some research, but you guys must be able to get the data. I mean, you're a government organization. He said, in America at the moment, you don't put your head over the parapet. They don't ask for any data whatsoever because they'll get suspended. So that was, I mean, that's where we're at. It's worth putting on the table, I think.
Okay.
Thank you. Anthony, just a comment around inflation. Inflation that we've seen from QE has been passed on through price inflation, but we've seen a lot of asset price inflation. So we might have observed in house 20 years ago selling for $130,000. It could be selling at six times that. That's massive inflation for people who might not own any housing going into retirement, and they might be paying it through rents or other means, or trying to acquire housing at that point. So I guess going forward, like, it's how you measure it. Like, we've been reporting 2.5% inflation or whatever over many years, but if they incorporated a great proportion of, say, in housing expenses, we would have observed other inflation. So whether we'll see the impact of QE flowing through to price inflation, we just don't know. They might change the measurement yardstick in the future.
Good point, I agree. Mm. We don't know.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Can I just say, so this is an information note. So it could turn into a guidance note if we come to agreements on points so please do let us know. Otherwise, you might be at risk of being to follow a guidance note when you don't want to. So our emails are there, and I would think another three or four months before we get finalised.
So I'll just put in a bid now that I'd be utterly amazed if this went to guidance note any time in our even medium-term futures. The reason I say that is because, well, it's relatively green field, and we can't even move beyond information notes on things that have been around for 10, 15 years. So, you know, target surplus, for example, is information note. Certainly, I don't think this type of thing should move anywhere near guidance note until we've moved a number of other things well beyond information note, which I equally don't see happening anytime soon. So, kind of surprised a little bit that debate's around. I think it's a valuable contribution to the profession as an information note. But that's how it should stay, I think, for any time frame that I care to imagine right now.
Point noted.
Okay, any other questions? While you think, one last one for me. Paul, the Singapore scheme, I think this might have been the subject of a paper that you once wrote. What are the key learnings from the Singapore experience?
A few words about the Singapore scheme. Singaporeans save through the Central Provident Fund, and the contributions of those are very large, from both the employee and the employer, up to 30% of earnings. But you can use your CPF savings for housing purposes, so it's not only for retirement. They introduced the scheme, or their old scheme had people being paid out over 20 years, so basically they had a sort of annuity certain for 20 years after they reached their retirement age. and they did figure out that people were going to live longer than that. So originally retirement was 62, so being paid out till age 82 wasn't nearly long enough. They have the big advantage that it's compulsory. They've got excellent data, so we know what the mortality rates of the relevant members of the population were going to be. Or we thought we did. And therefore we're able to price it on a basis that was, I guess, reasonably well assured. The scheme invests in government bonds that pay 1% over the prevailing 10-year government bond rate, but they've never gone below 4%, even though government bonds rate sort of 2.5 plus 1 is 3.5, they've always credited 4%. So there's no investment risk that has actually been visited on the members of the scheme. One learning is that people are surprisingly irrational. They gave people a number of choices as to whether they wanted to have a product that focused on income and that didn't have any payouts on death, or a product that focused on that was more balanced and had a payout on death as well as an income. And you might expect the people who would choose the no death benefit to be the ones who expected to live the longest, but that's not what the experience has shown. More rationally, we find that people with big balances have lower mortality rates than people with small balances. So that would correlate with your earnings, your lifestyle, your socioeconomic status. To get any closer to cause and effect on that is tricky. Singapore originally designed the scheme without inflation. They kind of like to think that inflation was sort of next to nothing. Which is clearly not the case, so they've now introduced an option that does have an escalating benefit at 2%. So it's a fixed 2%, so actually being prepared to design a scheme that was inflation-linked was a step too far. And when I said that we thought we knew what the membership of CPF's mortality rates were, and we could measure them, it was a good thing we actually got them too high, because there was strong risk aversion to payouts going down. And by having mortality rates that were, we had them too low, which meant there were mortality surpluses. And even though those mortality surpluses are quite small, there would have been a lot of aversion to them being negative. So that in a government scheme, they have an interesting balance between the government facilitating a process that is actually then non-governmental. But if it goes wrong, it'll reflect badly on the government. And the insurer could find themselves in the same position, that if it goes wrong and they haven't represented what the risks are, then it'll reflect badly on them. But if you're building margins in, then the impact will be on lower payouts until those margins have worked their way through the system. I could go on for hours, but I think I'll stop there.
And I think we might stop there. So thank you very much for coming today, and please thank Anthony and Paul. And don't forget to send your comments to either Anthony or Paul on the draft information note. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Darren.